James chapter 3, verses 1 to 12. So in this passage, James is interested in the tongue, not from an anatomical perspective. It isn't the tongue's composition, it's muscles and nerves and blood vessels that he's interested in. It's rather the tongue as an instrument of speech. That's what draws him to this particular bodily organ. James isn't writing as a scientist concerned with the human body. He's writing as a pastor concerned with the way that Christians speak. And as we study these verses together then, there are three things that I want us to notice. First of all, the relevance of the tongue. The relevance of the tongue. James begins this passage in an odd way. Not many of you, he says, should become teachers. He doesn't mean school teachers. He means teachers in a church context, Bible teachers, pastors, in other words. Now, at one of our services last Sunday, I prayed concerning the need for pastors to fill the vacant pulpits in evangelical churches up and down our land. I'm sure the need for pastors is something which many of you think and pray about. Certainly it was very much on the Apostle Paul's radar. What you have heard from me in the presence of many witnesses, entrust to faithful men who will be able to teach others also, he famously urged Timothy in 2 Timothy 2 verse 2. Why on earth then does James say this? It doesn't seem very helpful of him. It's not exactly calculated to encourage what Paul clearly felt was needed and what many of us feel is needed, namely a steady stream of men coming forward for pastoral ministry. These austere words aren't going to encourage that. Not many of you should become teachers. It's an off-putting expression, of the kind which sows doubts and misgivings in tender, sensitive souls. Why does James write like that? Well, probably because many of his first readers are not tender, sensitive souls who need to be gently encouraged to contemplate pastoral ministry. Rather, in this church, there are plenty of guys coming forward for it and doing so very confidently, considering themselves ideal candidates for the role, because they were fantastic men of God. They had mastered the Christian life pretty much to the point of perfection. That's how these would-be teachers among James's readers viewed themselves. And it's why then James begins verse 2, "We all stumble in many ways." He's bursting their ridiculous bubble. He's saying no one this side of heaven reaches the kind of heights that you're claiming for yourselves. No one masters the Christian life. Perfection eludes all of us. And in between the two sentences in verse 2, we're probably to imagine the reply that these guys would have made to that. What do you mean, James, when you say we all stumble in many ways? How do we stumble then? We aren't adulterers, we aren't thieves, we aren't drunkards, we aren't tax evaders. How have we not arrived at perfection in the Christian life? And thus James writes that second sentence in verse 2, "If anyone does not stumble in what he says, he is a perfect man." You see, James knows that that's the great moral deficiency that these men have. That's why their enthusiasm to become teachers in the church is misguided and needs to have cold water poured over it. Their speech, the way that they speak, is unacceptable. Not the way they speak when they're teaching. They speak well enough then. It's the way they speak when they're not teaching that is the problem. The way they speak to and about other people. He has these men who desperately want to be in the pulpit, in mind in verse 9. These men bless their Lord and Father. That's what they do when they are in the pulpit. When they're standing there at the lectern expounding some text of scripture, then they speak such rich, God-honoring, doxological words. But these men also curse people who are made in the likeness of God. That's what they do when they're out of the pulpit and someone has wronged them or irritated them or provoked them in some way. They verbally lash out in bitter curses. If anyone does not stumble in what he says, he is a perfect man. So you guys are not paragons of Christian perfection as you think you are. That's James's point. You aren't the outstanding pulpit material which you see yourselves as. You have a serious problem, and that problem is the way that you speak. But again, you see, in between verse 2 and verse 3, we're probably to imagine another reply coming from these men. This time, something like this. Oh, it's the way that we speak that you're bothered about, James. So it's not something serious after all. You're just being pernickety and hair-splitting. How we speak doesn't matter. That's not important. A bit of bad-mouthing is no big deal. That doesn't take the gloss off our fantastic Christian characters. And thus, James writes verses 3 and 4. Where he argues that dismissing a person's speech as unimportant is like dismissing a horse's bit as unimportant, or a ship's rudder as unimportant. Of course, either of those claims would be ridiculous. If you're trying to ride a horse, few things are more key than the bit in the animal's mouth. If you're trying to get a ship from A to B, few things are more key than the rudder. And within a human life, James says, the tongue has that level of significance. That's what the first half of verse 5 means. At this point, he's not being negative, I think, about the tongue. He will be in the second half of verse 5 and beyond. But here in the first half of verse 5, he's not saying that the tongue boasts in an arrogant sense. Rather, he's saying the tongue can legitimately boast of being very important. It can make the same boast in that regard as a horse's bit can or a ship's rudder can. I want to pause at this point then, because it's possible that we, like these men in this church who feel so qualified to teach, it's possible that we could be similarly dismissive about the importance of our everyday speech. And so the constantly critical, fault-finding words that you speak to your wife, the disrespectful words that you speak to your parents, the smutty words that you speak to your colleagues in order to fit in when they're all having a laugh, the belittling words that you speak to a Christian brother or sister at church who's socially awkward and gets on your nerves, none of that matters enormously. It's not really an indicator of where you're at in your Christian life, of how you're doing as a disciple of Jesus, because it's just words. That's all it is. It's just words. We can slip into that kind of thinking, and we mustn't. It represents a huge miscalculation. Keep always in mind the horse's bit and the ship's rudder. Never dismiss sinful speech with the word just or the word only. There's nothing just or only about speech. The tongue is of the utmost relevance. And so that's the first thing we need to notice in these verses, the relevance of the tongue. But then secondly, the reality of the tongue, the reality of the tongue. So having established the matter of relevance, that a bad tongue is not an inconsequential issue, James now proceeds to expose just how bad the human tongue is. He says four things about it. First of all, it's destructive. It's destructive. The tongue, he says in verse 6, is a fire. A fire. There are few things in this world more destructive than fire. I mean, you think of Jesus talking in Matthew 6, verse 20, about moths wrecking stuff. And certainly they do, or they can. But the idea of destructive moths has a much gentler feel to it, doesn't it, than the idea of destructive fire. But James doesn't go for the gentler option here that Jesus goes for in the Sermon on the Mount. He doesn't describe the tongue as a moth. He describes it as fire. And in fact, he doesn't just liken the tongue to one of the world's most destructive things. He likens it to one of the world's most destructive things when it is at its most destructive. Namely, when it's raging through a forest, verse 5. We know about that, don't we? We've seen images of this kind of thing on the news. I mean, a building goes up in flames, and even if it's a huge building like the Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris, normally within a few hours the firefighters have it under control. A forest on fire, however, that's a different matter. It can keep on going for days, it can keep on going for weeks, even months perhaps. And so fire, I'm saying, at its most destructive, is how James describes the tongue. And he's not exaggerating. Through the speaking of words, reputations can be ruined. Friendships can be ruined. Marriages can be ruined. Churches can be ruined. The tongue is destructive. Secondly, it's corrupting. It's corrupting. He refers to it staining the whole body, verse 6, and also in the same verse, to it setting on fire the entire course of life. They're not so much its fiery destructiveness in relation to friendships and marriages and churches, things out there, but its fiery self-destructiveness. And I think the point here then is that bad speech often spreads into other areas of behavior. So if you get into the habit of speaking ill about a particular person, then eventually, when that habit is so ingrained, eventually it will seem a small thing to steal from that person whom you have trounced so much with your tongue. Or perhaps to assault that person, or to betray that person in some significant way. There again, if you're a man and you start using smutty language about women with your mates, and it keeps going and becomes ingrained, then eventually it will seem a small thing to think smuttily about women, and indeed to behave smuttily toward women. And you get the idea then. Sins of the tongue don't tend to remain sins of the tongue. It's corrupting. Thirdly, it's sinister. It's sinister. We talk, don't we, as Christians, about the world, the flesh, and the devil. I think James refers to two of those here in verse 6. Certainly he refers to the world. That word is clearly there, a world of unrighteousness. And when he says then that the tongue is set on fire by hell, I mean, it's a bit difficult to envisage what he means there, but I think he probably means it's set on fire by the devil, who with all the rebellious angels is already in some sense in hell, according to 2 Peter 2 verse 4. And James's point then is that of all our members, to use his language, of all our body parts, These sinister forces, the world and the devil, they make particular use of the human tongue. We often miss that. We think that worldliness is limbs covered in tattoos, or a woman's hair that's very short, or a man's hair that's very long. But limbs and hair aren't the body parts through which the world and the devil primarily operates. It's the tongue. Worldliness is the tongue, gossiping and boasting and lying and raging. That's worldliness. So the tongue is destructive, like fire, corrupting, affecting other areas of behavior, sinister. This conduit for the world and the devil. And then fourthly, it's wild. It's wild. Verse 8 is so stark, isn't it? No human being can tame the tongue. And James talks about all the different things that can be tamed. All these animals that can be tamed. But no human being can tame the tongue. You think of these footballers. And they can control a ball with such elegance. And they can control their own bodies in the sense of dieting and fitness regimes, making sure they go to the gym every day and they run so many miles each day and all the rest of it. But then they're on the pitch and they get sent off. They get a red card. Why? Because they've sworn at the referee. They can control so much. Brilliant at controlling all kinds of things, and yet they can't control the tongue. The tongue is wild, untamable, James says. And so, as I say, James exposes how bad the human tongue is. It's not just a bit problematic. It doesn't just get people into scrapes from time to time. No, the tongue is destructive. The tongue is corrupting. The tongue is sinister. And the tongue is wild. That's the reality of this organ that we're talking about. So the relevance of the tongue and the reality of the tongue. But then thirdly and finally this evening, the renewal of the tongue. The renewal of the tongue. So as I said before, in verses 9 and the first half of 10, James is probably talking about these men who are clamoring to be teachers in the church, and these men whose speaking is so refined and so elegant and so edifying in the pulpit. They bless their Lord and Father there, but whose speech is so abusive and so malicious, often outside the pulpit, cursing those made in the likeness of God. And notice then that having mentioned them in verse 9 and the first half of verse 10, then in the second half of verse 10, he addresses these guys and he says, "My brothers, these things ought not to be so." It ought not to be like that. Your speech outside of the pulpit shouldn't be like that. Shouldn't be full of cursing and malice and abuse and hurt. And I suppose in the immediate context here, James, speaking as strongly as that there in the second half of verse 10, could seem a little puzzling. Because we could respond to James, but hang on, if the human tongue is as bad as you have just described it in verses 5 and 6, and well, 7 and 8 as well, if the human tongue is destructive and corrupting and sinister and wild, then how can you expect any different in these men whom you're addressing here? Surely it's inevitable that curses are going to escape their lips, that they're going to speak nastily and viciously at times. Because you've just told us what the human tongue is like. How can you hold this against them? having given such a bleak description of the human tongue in those verses? Well, in answer to that, we have to remember not just the immediate context, but we have to remember the broader context. We have to cast our minds back to chapter 1, and two verses in particular in chapter 1. One is verse 18. This is what James says about Christians: of his, that's God's own will, he brought us forth by the word of truth. What does that mean? Well, if you're at the meeting on Wednesday night, you will know what that means. Reese was talking about the new birth, regeneration. That's what James is talking about there. God has given us new birth. He's made us new people. And then just a couple of verses later, verse 21. Remember, James refers to the implanted word. And we said he's not talking there about some sense of God that's implanted in all human beings, although that may be true. He's talking about the law which God has written on the hearts of those who are his, those whom he has regenerated and brought to new birth. And so James has already established in this letter that as Christians, something massive has happened to us. It's not just that we've made a decision for Jesus. No, a massive transformation has occurred. We've been born again. We've had the law of God written into our hearts. That's what has happened. And notice then in verse 12, the first half of verse 12, James says, "Can a fig tree, my brothers..." I'm back in chapter 3 now. "Can a fig tree, my brothers, bear olives, or a grapevine produce figs?" He's saying, isn't he, then, that there's a certain kind of fruit that is incompatible with the nature of the tree. If the tree is a fig tree, then olives are incompatible with its nature. If it's a grapevine, then figs are incompatible with his nature. There's a certain kind of fruit that is simply incompatible with the nature of the tree. And James's point then is that bad speech is incompatible with this new nature which we have as Christians. We've been born again. We have a new nature. And bad speech, which yes is natural and inevitable in the person who hasn't been born again, that person still in verses 5 to 8 territory. But bad speech in a person who has been born again, that's figs on a grapevine, that's grapes on a fig tree. He says at the end of verse 12 that a salt pond can't yield fresh water. And his point is then that you guys that I'm addressing, you guys aren't salt ponds. You're fresh ponds. And so fresh water, fresh speech, good words should be flowing out of you. And so this, I'm saying, is how James can write so strongly in the second half of verse 10, "My brothers, these things ought not to be so." Because he's writing to people who have been changed, people who have been made new. He's not writing to people still in their native state, in which they're bound to speak badly. He's writing to people who have been made new, people who have been made fresh ponds, and from whom therefore fresh water should come. And it's such an important approach that James uses here. It's so like Paul, actually. I mean, people, you still encounter people saying, you know, that James and Paul, they're just on such a different wavelength and they're contradicting each other all the time and all the rest of it. I hope we demonstrated in the key passage last week that that's not the case there, where it's particularly alleged. But often, actually, you get little touches of Paul in James. And this approach is one, the way in which, with the Apostle Paul, He doesn't, his approach when exhorting his readers to live better, his approach is not, look, here's what you're working towards and you've just got to try harder and harder and harder until you reach it. That's not his approach. His approach is rather, this is what you are now. This is what grace has made you. This is what God has done for you in the new birth. Therefore, it's outrageous, it's preposterous that you should be behaving like this. That's Paul's approach. And that's James's approach here. It's not like, look, guys, nice speech is a really good ideal and you should be working toward that until you get there. No, he's saying, you have been made new, therefore bad speech is preposterous. It's incompatible. It shouldn't be there. Be indignant about it. And it's an approach that I think we lack often. I'm not just talking about in the area of speech, but in the area of Christian living generally. The trouble is we see ourselves as salt ponds still. We see ourselves as still where we were before we were Christians. And as though there's a certain inevitability about salt water, about bad stuff coming from us. And we don't realize that we're not those people anymore. We talk about total depravity and we talk about it as though as Christians we're still totally depraved. We're not. That's what we were. We're not depraved people now. We're dead to sin and alive to God in Christ Jesus now. We're new creatures now. We're fresh ponds now. And so rather than seeing slipping and stumbling and falling as inevitable through another week now that we're going into, we should be saying to ourselves, it's outrageous that I should live like that this week. It's outrageous that I should speak nastily to someone. That I should behave with lust or with covetousness or with disrespect or whatever it might be. I'm new. I'm new. And that stuff is incompatible. Brothers, these things ought not to be so. May we have that stronger view of sanctification, not struggling towards a high and unattainable bar, but we have been made new, therefore we live out that newness. May we do that this week to God's glory. Amen.